Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. It's open forum. Your call, welcome. 888-3187-884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Mr. Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Mr. Cyril Kellett.
It's very nice to see you again. It's a good week for me. I've gotten to see you a lot this week. We got to work together a little this morning.
Not all of it on the air, too.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So tomorrow is Black Elk? Oh, today was Black Elk.
No, that's for a pre-record we did.
I did that thing.
You've sorry, done the Billy Jimmy. Pilgrim thing and become unstuck in time.
I'm sorry. That's why I just don't handle pre-records well. So we recorded a show that was going to air in July, and I just gave it away, I guess.
I don't mind that. It's fine.
Tomorrow's program on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Today's program, because today is Friday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So last week we talked about the DC snipers incident from 2002 and what the public knew about how law enforcement managed to catch them. Mm-hmm. But there was a whole other side to the story that the public didn't know about and that almost nobody knows about up until today. But I learned about it. And so today I interviewed the person who was directly involved in the hidden side of this story. And since it's already out, I'll go ahead and reveal who that person is. Her name is Pam Coronado, and she is a psychic detective.
Oh, really?
She was called in by the FBI on day two of the DC Beltway Snipers crisis, and she had like 13 hits in terms of what she perceived about the Beltway Snipers that turned out to be true. And so I talk with her about her work on that case, as well as her work on other cases and other psychic detectives working with police as well. Pam has a collection of patches from the different police agencies she's worked with, and she's got like 50 patches or something. And according to her, 99% of police departments, in fact, do work with psychics to generate leads, even if they don't talk about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
And that's not the same thing as solving a case, because even when a psychic detective gets a lead, the police still have to build an evidential case. You know,
oh, of course.
You
can't, right.
You can't go into court and say the psychic said it's this person. You have to find physical evidence and other evidence that you can use in court. So they can generate leads, but they can't, the police and courts won't simply take their word.
I have to say, she should sell her story for TV because Pam. She has? Pam Coronado, psychic detective. That's like such a title. That would be.
The actual title of the series she's been in is called Sensing Murder.
Oh, okay. I will look for that. Yeah. Jimmy Akin, our guest, you're welcome to call. Let me tell you how many lines are open. I'll take a quick look. Oh, well, we better go to the phones, get some lines open for you. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, since they're all full, shall we?
Sure.
All right, let's go to Diego in New Hampshire, listening on EWTN. Diego, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Before I was waiting on the last segment, so before I actually ask my question, I want to make a comment. You talked about the future cockroach overlords.
Oh, maybe Jimmy. Remember that? Maybe Jimmy doesn't know about the future cockroach overlords.
But I just want to say that I do know one commandment the future cockroach overlords will say.
Give it to me.
Do not vacuum the floor of the kitchen.
No, that's a cockroach is terrified of the vacuum.
Exactly. Separate from that, I had this question from a Protestant, and I gave an answer, but I want to hear Mr. Akin's comments because his book, Daily Defense, is spectacular.
Thank you.
During Henry VIII's time, when the bishops signed the letter of supremacy or proclamation of supremacy, every single bishop signed it except one.
Mm-hmm. St. John Fisher, right.
From the question of following the magisterium, when do you obey your bishops if they're doing something that seems in opposition to the Pope? And in reverse, what if the Pope says something crazy, like Pope Alexander's behavior had been in the in the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, and our bishops say, no, the Pope is wrong. How do you navigate those two potential troubles with the magisterium?
Okay, so it's true that popes can make mistakes when they're not speaking infallibly, and bishops can make mistakes when they're not speaking infallibly as a body together, which can occur either in an ecumenical council or through what's known as the ordinary and universal magisterium of the church. So the first thing you kind of got to do is figure out, is this a matter of doctrine, whatever decision they've announced, whether it's a pope or a bishop, and if so, is it taught infallibly? And if in either case, a pope or a bishop has infallibly taught a matter of doctrine, then that person is guaranteed, or those people are guaranteed to be right, because the Holy Spirit protects the church from teaching infallibly anything that is false. And so if it's infallible, it's guaranteed to be right. And you would thus go with that. Now, beyond that, it gets a little murkier. In the Holy Spirit does guide the Pope and the bishops in such a way that, at least as a body, they're going to teach in unison. And there can be periods in history where there's some, you know, lack of clarity about exactly what the truth is on a given matter. And we'll suppose it's a doctrinal matter for the moment. And there's no one-size-fits-all answer here. If they're teaching non-infallibly, then they're not guaranteed to be right. And they're probably right because the Holy Spirit's guiding them, but they're not guaranteed to be right. And so if you have a disagreement between a bishop and a pope, or a group of bishops and a pope, on a non-infallible matter, it's possible that the bishops are correct. And there's no easy way to just say, oh, go with this group or go with that group, you know, go with the Pope or go with the bishops. What one would have to do in that situation is study the matter and see, you know, based on what Scripture says and what tradition says, try to make a determination about who has the correct understanding of this non-infallible matter. Things get even murkier when we get out of the realm of doctrine and into other realms like law, because laws are not true or false. Laws guide behavior, and sometimes laws, considering them from a certain point of view, laws are behavioral regulations, but they're not always necessarily just. And so one has to figure out, is this a just law? Does it apply to this situation? And one has to then work through that. Then there are matters that go beyond law, which are not even connected with church discipline directly, like personal opinion. And they could be opinions about liturgy or opinions about science or opinions about any number of things. And even though we need to give a respectful consideration to the opinion of both popes and bishops, we're not obliged to hold the same opinions that they do, because these are matters of opinion, not matters of teaching or matters of law. And so we want to give them a respectful hearing, but we wouldn't be obliged to agree with either one of them because it's a matter of free opinion. If you'd like more on all that, I wrote a whole book called Teaching with Authority that explains all these different categories and goes through them in depth with examples, including examples from history. So, Diego, if you'll stay on the line, why don't we see if we can send you a copy of Teaching with Authority, and you can have a deep dive on these subjects.
Wonderful. Do hang on. I'm just going to put you on hold, Diego, and Thomas will get your information, and we will send that off to you. We got to take a quick break. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin's our guest. Right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
We should pray because prayer is conversation with God, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship. We need that relationship with God. We should pray and talk with God. about what's on our hearts, what's on our minds, what's active in our lives, the joys we have. We should share all of these with God. Prayer is conversation, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship. All of our other relationships depend on this one.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I was trying to explain to Jimmy how we got to the future cockroach overlords.
Usually it involves nuclear war.
Yeah, no, this was like the just the philosophical, the possibility of the end of the human race. And then we were, Trent and I were asking, well, how would the human race come back? And somehow it came out that the cockroaches evolved into a second race of human beings. And Trent said, that's I welcome our future cockroach overlords.
Yeah, quote from Kent Brockman on The Simpsons. It's extremely evolutionarily implausible that cockroaches could evolve into human beings.
I find that's a great relief, Jimmy. I'm glad that you said that. I feel better. We're going to Saskatchewan now in Canada. Jason's in Saskatchewan. Thank you very much, Jason, for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. My question for Jimmy is, what are some elements of compatibility between First Nations religions and traditions and Catholicism? Mm-hmm. And what are the major points of division between the two?
Okay, so by First Nations, do you mean First Nations people who are living specifically in Canada, or are you talking about North American Native Americans in general?
Well, I mean, one of the questions I have is, to what extent are they compatible with each other? Like, how many variations mm-hmm. are there? But I am specifically talking like Plains Native Americans in the United States. Mm-hmm. Or again, in Canada, we tend to refer to them as First Nations people.
Right.
Okay.
So I haven't studied Canadian First Nation people in any depth. I know a little bit about some groups. For example, the Tlingit, who live in Alaska and the western part of Canada, they and a number of other tribes in that area believe in reincarnation. And they don't believe in the reincarnation. They don't believe in reincarnation the way it's understood in India. They have their own beliefs about it. For example, they commonly believe that you only come back, or some of them believe you only come back as a member of your own family. So people get reborn down the generations. They also have other beliefs connected with this. They believe that sometimes a person can foretell who he's going to reincarnate as. They believe that birthmarks may serve as confirming evidence that this person is the same person as, you know, grandpa who died. They believe that sometimes announcing dreams happen, where someone gets a dream that says grandpa is coming back and he's going to be your new son. And some of those are rather distinctive. Like, it's not very common among reincarnation believers to think that you can foretell who you're going to come back as, but the Tlingit and some other tribes do believe that. Also, they don't think karma has anything to do with reincarnation. They don't have the concept of karma. There's a famous reincarnation case that was studied by Ian Stevenson, about a boy named Corliss Chotkin Jr., who was foretold by his grandfather, Victor Vincent, that he was going to come back as his niece's son. And then Corliss Chotkin displayed apparent memories of having been Victor Vincent. I talk about that case and things that can explain it in an upcoming episode of Mysterious World. It's going to be coming out, I believe, it's either August or September. And there are other ways of explaining it besides reincarnation. In fact, I'm going to propose a theory that I think explains all the data from reincarnation cases extremely well, but that does not involve reincarnation. So you can stay tuned to Mysterious World for that. But belief in reincarnation is something that would be a difference between, you know, because Christianity does not teach reincarnation. Christianity teaches resurrection, as illustrated by what happened with Jesus. He rose from the dead, and the New Testament reveals our fate is going to be the same as Jesus's. We're going to rise from the dead as well. However, there are elements that different groups, you know, because different Native American or First Nations groups have different beliefs, you know, that you really have to consider an individual tribe and what this tribe believes. And there are some that are related, like in the American Southwest, the Hopi and the Navajo, or I'm sorry, the Zuni and the Hopi have some common religious beliefs. There's a particular site just next to the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River. It's a calcium carbonate mound known as the Sipapuni, and it has a hole in it and water flows up through the hole. And it's kind of the Zuni Hopi equivalent of the Garden of Eden. They believe that the Sipapuni is where humankind emerged into our world from a deeper world. There's also a place in Arizona known as Zuni Heaven, where they believe their souls go when they die. Well, those would be differences, you know, because Christianity doesn't hold those things. But there can be similarities. Starting in a couple of weeks, I have a pair of episodes about a man named Black Elk, which Cy Kellett referred to. Black Elk was a Lakota medicine man, and he had various paranormal experiences, which I'm going to be talking about. He also became a Christian, and he's up for sainthood. His cause for canonization has been filed by the Diocese of Rapid City. And one of the prominent themes in these two episodes, especially the second one, is how to untangle what's compatible with Christianity and what's not. The priests who ministered at the reservation where Black Elk lived were Jesuits, and the Lakota specifically requested Jesuits because they had a lot of respect for them. And one of the things that Jesuits are known for doing historically is trying to untangle what's compatible in a native culture with Catholicism and what's not. And a famous example of that is what's known as the Chinese Rites controversy, where Jesuits were doing missionary work in China, and they would adapt themselves to those Chinese customs that they believed were compatible with the Christian faith. And there was disagreement about that with some other groups like the Franciscans, but eventually the Vatican ruled in favor of the Jesuits and said, yeah, they were right, these things are compatible. So Jesuits have a long history of trying to look for what's compatible and what's not. In the case of Lakota beliefs, many Lakota are, even if they're not Christians, are monotheist. They refer to God as Wakantanka, which is Lakota for the great mystery. And so they are frequently monotheistic. That's a point of similarity. They also, Black Elk, even before he was a Christian, had a vision of Jesus Christ as the chief of the two legs. Two legs meaning human beings, animals are four legs. And so, they belief in Jesus in some form was viewed as compatible with Lakota religion. Also, there was a movement in the Great Plains in the late 19th century known as the Ghost Dance religion, which also said Jesus is coming back really soon, and he's going to help the Indians. He's going to drive the most, at least, of the Europeans back to their own continent, and the buffalo are going to come back, and we're going to get to meet our deceased relatives, and everything's going to be great. And so there were obviously Christian elements in the Ghost Dance religion, but there were also non-Christian elements in it. And the Jesuits would try to do things like, so what in these ceremonies is compatible with Christianity? Like in smoking a pipe is a common ceremony in many First Nations Native American cultures. And it's sometimes done as a form of prayer. And so the Jesuits looked at that and said, well, that's basically the same as incense. A pipe is essentially a censer, you know, an incense holder. And the Bible uses incense as a form of prayer. It talks about the smoke of the incense ascending before God. So if you want to smoke a pipe as a form of prayer, as opposed to just a social custom, that wouldn't contradict the Catholic faith. It's just incense in another form. So they did some really interesting work, and I would suggest checking out the two episodes on Nicholas Black Elk for a deeper dive into those subjects.
Well, thank you very, very much for the question. You can find it at mysterious.fm. Or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and you will come to it. Jason, thanks very much for the question. I'm going to go to Fontana, California, listening on Facebook. Dan in Fontana. Dan, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
Yeah, my question is that recently Catholic Answers had a some commentary about the validity of Mass regarding what, you know, what actions the priest may take or omit. Mm-hmm. And I found myself at Mass. I'm 65 years old. I've been Catholic all my life. I was at Mass last Sunday, and I found myself getting nervous because at the offertory, the priest did not have water being added to the wine. Mm-hmm. And he remembered to bring an altar server to bring the water over. And I've seen a couple times where there was no water added to the wine. So at that point, are we supposed to say, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it? Or do I get up and leave and go to another Mass? Or do I just shake my head? Or what do you do? And then I have a comment I'd like to say after you answer.
Okay. Well, water, even though it's required for laicity, meaning the law requires it, it is not required for validity. And, you know, different quantities of, I mean, there is already water in wine. That's why it's a liquid. Or that's part of why it's a liquid. And so there's already water in there, and there doesn't have to be a specific amount of water. So if a priest fails to put water in the wine, let's say he just forgets, it's not going to affect the validity of the consecration. And consequently, it's a mistake. But it would be a judgment call. Do you want to say, hey, Father, you forgot to put in the water if it's, you know, sitting right there? But that can be a little disruptive. And my suspicion is that, if Pope Benedict, who I use as kind of a liturgical reference point, if he was up on the altar and concelebrating with a priest who had forgotten to put water into the wine, he might nudge him and privately say it. But I doubt that Pope Benedict, if he was sitting on the front row, would yell out and disrupt the Mass in that way. So my suspicion, if you're, the consecration is going to be valid, and my suspicion is if you're sitting in the congregation, I'd let it slide because the consecration is going to be valid anyway. This Mass has a minor defect, but it doesn't really affect anything beyond that. And so I might mention to the priest after Mass and say, hey, Father, I noticed you accidentally forgot to put water in the wine, just as a memory jogger for him in the future.
Dan, you can go ahead.
Water.
Go ahead. What's that?
Even too much water?
Well, it says that what it says is that a small amount of water is to be mixed with the wine, and it doesn't say how much. The answer to how much will still be valid is any amount that does not stop the result from appearing to be wine in the common estimation of men. I mean, if he put a drop of wine into the chalice and a cup of water, the result would not be wine in the common estimation of men. But if it still would be wine in the common estimation of men, if you gave it to someone and said, you know, unconsecrated, let's say, if you gave it to someone and say, drink this, what is it? If they would took a sip and said, oh, that's wine, then it's going to be valid. So the text of the current liturgical rite does not encourage scrupulosity on this point. And there's no real practical way, unless the priest was doing something ridiculous, like using a gallon container of water, and using all of a gallon container of water, there's no way for someone in the audience to make a practical judgment about is that too much enough or not, because you need more up close and even gustatory knowledge of what's in the cup. You need to take a taste and see, does that seem to be wine or not? And so I don't see a practical way to make use of alerting the priest to too much in ordinary situations. It'd have to be some weird extreme situation. But if you did see something like that, you could always mention it to the priest after Mass.
Dan, thank you very, very much. I hope that that was helpful to you. This, I don't usually keep track of these things, but second time this week we've heard the word gustatory on this program, Jimmy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And we rarely hear the word gustatory. So this is a big week for us. We're going to take a very quick break. There's one line open, 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Your call is welcome. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God. And it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum, and Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. We've got a summertime book sale going on right now, $10 book sale, 25 of our bestsellers and new titles on sale for just $10 per book, and you can get it at shop.catholic.com. You don't need a promo code, but it does end Monday night, June 26th, Honolulu time. So get your books before then, a $10 book sale right now at shop.catholic.com. Andrew is in Michigan, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website. Andrew, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi, Andrew.
Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. First, I have a question for Cy. How many lines do you have?
Six.
Wait, when you say you have one line open, like how many lines are there?
There's six.
Six, okay. I always try to do the math whenever you're saying that, and so this is helpful. Anyway, so I was talking to a friend of mine about the fall of the angels, and he said that his opinion was they fell when Jesus was born, which was an odd interpretation of Revelation to me. He's talking about Revelation 12, where the narrative is the woman appears and the child is, she's about to give birth to the child, and then the angels fall, and then she gives birth. And so he's trying to tie that all into Christmas. And, you know, it was always my opinion that the angels fell before the fall of man. So how would you respond to that?
Well, I would I would say that I think that Revelation 12 is a pretty weak foundation for holding that demons as a group, meaning all of them, fell when Jesus was born. There are other ways of reading Genesis 12. And so the passage that's referred to is John sees a great red dragon in the sky that refers to the devil, and it sweeps away a third of the stars in heaven with its tail. And a lot of people have looked at that and said, oh, that third of the stars being swept away means a third of the angels fell. And that's possible because stars are sometimes used as symbols of angels. But also, to quote or to bend a phrase from Sigmund Freud, sometimes a star is just a star. And stars falling, which is what the devil is causing to happen here, is a symbol of judgment. There are other passages where trials and tribulations like wars and things like that are described in biblical symbolism in the Old Testament with the image of stars falling, because that would be a catastrophe if all of the stars in heaven started falling. And so it gets used as a general symbol of a catastrophe, not specifically the fall of angels into becoming demons. So I think there are other ways to read this text, and so it's a speculative interpretation. The other point I would mention is that we have evidence for demons in the Old Testament who are already fallen. In Deuteronomy, it says that the gods of the nations are Shadim, and Shed is the Hebrew word for demon, so Shadim, it would mean the gods of the nations are demons. We also see in the book of Tobit, there is the young woman in the book is being married to husbands who are then being killed by a demon named Asmodeus. And in the Greek text of Tobit, it will use, you know, the Greek word daimon, which is the same word the New Testament uses for demons. And obviously, since it's killing human beings, this demon is a destructive evil spirit. And so we have evidence for the existence of demons prior to the birth of Christ. Now, there's a question about just how far back was it that we started having demons fall? And the most common opinion historically in Catholic circles has been that God created the angels before he created us, and that in the first moment of their existence, some of the angels, not necessarily a third, but some of the angels chose against God. He gave all of the angels a free choice in that moment, just like he gives us a free choice over the course of our lifetimes. And some of them chose badly and became demons. So that's the most common opinion historically in Catholic circles. It is not the most common opinion in Jewish circles. In Jewish circles, there are several origins of demons. The equivalent, the devil, we have evidence he was, in the form of the serpent. He obviously fell early. That's another instance, by the way, of a demon before the time of Christ's birth, because the devil's all the way back there in the garden in Genesis. And it was also common in Jewish literature for a really long time to hold that additional demons got made at the time just before the Great Flood and during the Great Flood. And there have been several different periods in history when demons came about, according to Jewish texts. So the assumption that all the demons fell at once is not necessarily true. It's based on philosophical arguments about, you know, how do demon minds work. But if you look at the biblical data and other data from Jewish literature, it actually could be that they fell several different times. And there's even a passage in St. Paul where he, in 1 Corinthians, where he seems to hint that some angels could fall in the future. So I'd say we have to be careful about exactly what we assert about when they fell, but we do have evidence of them falling before the birth of Christ, at least some of them, and of them, at least some of them, like Satan, being there at the very beginning of the human race.
Andrew, I'm going to say thanks and leave it there because lines are quite full and we've got six of them. So that means lots of questions to answer as we go along. Let's go to Oklahoma. Mary, listening on the Sacred Heart Radio app. You are next, Mary. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I agree with church teaching about contraception and being open to children. Mm-hmm. And I understand that right now much of the world has a crisis in low birth rate and not having enough young people to take care of the aging population.
Yep.
But if everyone followed church teaching on this issue, wouldn't the planet eventually get overpopulated? And if
no,
we did get to that point, would
Go ahead.
It wouldn't, because the church's teaching is not that we need to abandon ourselves to, you know, have when husbands and wives engage in marital relations, the teaching is not that they can't do anything to regulate births, and so they just have to kind of abandon themselves to having children if they're going to have marital relations. The church teaches that people can regulate the births they have. They can use their reason to decide, in these circumstances, is it a good idea for us to have a kid or not? And if they conclude that it's not a good idea for them to have a kid, then they can take steps to avoid having a kid. They can work with the natural rhythms of fertility and infertility that are built into human women and avoid having relations when the woman is fertile. They can have relations at other times. And so so the church's teaching incorporates the regulation of births. It just says don't do it in a way that frustrates the design that God built into human sexuality. So don't get sterilized. Don't you know, thwart the natural process. And certainly don't kill the offspring with abortion. So work with God's design for human sexuality rather than thwarting it. And thus the world would not become overpopulated because parents would use the gift of reason. If everyone agreed with the church on this, parents would use their gift of reason to decide, is this an appropriate circumstance for us to have more kids or a certain number of kids? And parents would conclude, using that gift of reason, that no, we're getting in danger of overpopulation. We should cut back on the kid having.
Great. That's wonderful. That was very reassuring. Thank you.
No,
no problem.
All right, Mary, thank you very, very much for the call. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN is everywhere. EWTN radio programming is provided free of charge to over 500 domestic and international AM and FM radio stations. It's a great teaching tool for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. For a complete list of EWTN AM and FM stations across America, visit EWTNradio.net. At the bottom of the page, click Affiliates. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I was happy that Mary, in her question, pointed to the danger of depopulation and failing to repopulate the world. Jimmy's mic is potted down, I think. Have you got him potted? Oh, sorry, Jimmy.
Yeah, some of the engineers seem to enjoy potting me down. I guess they don't like me to talk.
They get so tired of you, Jimmy. They just pot them down. Just pot them down.
Yeah.
Tired of this. So thanks, Mary, for the call. Let's go to Fort Worth, Texas. Michelle's in Fort Worth, Texas, watching on YouTube. Michelle, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Hi, Jimmy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was wanting to know about I watched an episode just recently that I think you put out. It was about a psychic detective who uses her ability to solve, help solve, I don't know, cases with the police.
Yeah,
and
that's today's episode.
I'm having a hard time. Sorry?
That's today's episode.
Oh,
yes.
I was listening to it today, and then I went back and I listened to another episode because I was trying to get more clarity on previous episodes. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, is it morally acceptable for police departments, government agencies to use psychics to get information? I mean, especially if, what if they're getting this information from demonic influence? But like, aren't we to assume that for all psychics, or is that not the case for all psychics? Where's the line?
It's not the case for all psychics. So an episode that I'd recommend you listen to is episode 79. It's on religion, magic, psychic phenomena, and science. And I talk about those categories and what belongs in them. Psychic abilities, as they are understood, are natural human abilities. They're something that God built into human nature. So if they exist, that's what they are. They're part of our nature. And there's another pair of episodes I would suggest you listen to, which is episodes 105 and 106 on St. Thomas Aquinas and the occult. And one of the things I discuss, especially in episode 106, is Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, both doctors of the church, believed in what we would now call psychic powers. They both believed in precognition, which is the ability to supposedly pick up information from the future. And they believed this was a natural part of human nature. St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, refers to it as natural prophecy to distinguish it from the supernatural prophecy that God gives. St. Thomas Aquinas also believed in what today would be called psychokinesis, which is mind over matter. It was his explanation for the evil eye and how the evil eye works, how one person's hatred of another person can have a negative effect on that person. It would also be not only an example of psychokinesis, but also what in modern parapsychology is referred to as distant mental influence on living systems or demils. So the church has also been open to other psychic practices. In the 20th century, the church was actually involved in talking to dowsers who use various methods to try to find things, like, for example, finding water or finding oil or finding a missing person. And there was actually a French dowser who was hired by the Vatican to do some work at the Scavi, the excavations underneath the Vatican. And Pope Pius XI gave his blessing to a French group of dowsers. And, you know, he knows these are dowsers. They were actually making a donation to the Vatican Library. They were donating all their dowsing journals, you know, copies of them, to the Vatican Library. And he thanked them for the journals. He kept one to read himself, and he gave them the apostolic blessing. And in 1948, the Holy Office, which is the today it's called the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, but the Holy Office put down some regulations regarding what priests could do in dowsing consultations. And they didn't want priests using dowsing to do things like determine illnesses, you know, diagnose people or find lost people, because if they tried and they were wrong, it could cause a problem for the faithful. But they said, we have no problem at all with priests serving as dowsers for scientific research purposes. And consequently, also there were no restrictions on what laity could do as dowsers. So lay people could use dowsing for medical diagnoses or to find lost people or things like that, as far as the Vatican was concerned. So actually the church has been very open in all this. What the church has been less open to is talking to spirits. And so if you're talking to a spirit, there's a risk. It could be that it's not who you think. It could be that there's a demon. But the church doesn't have an absolute prohibition on talking to spirits, because if the Virgin Mary shows up and wants to talk to you, it's okay to talk to the Virgin Mary. You want to be careful to make sure it's really the Virgin Mary and not a demon impersonating her. But the attitude that we see in St. Paul and St. John in the New Testament doesn't say never talk to spirits. Instead, it says test the spirits to see whether they're of God or not. And that presupposes you are talking to spirits. So the New Testament actually expects us to talk to spirits and test them to see whether they're truthful and of God or not. So it, certainly if a psychic is not even trying to talk to spirits, they're just trying to use a native human ability, then they're not falling afoul of a biblical regulation or of church teaching. And if it turned out to be true that psychic functioning is real, which is something you can make up your own mind about, it wouldn't be wrong to use an ability God gave us, just like it's not wrong to use our vision and hearing and smell and taste. Even though some of them, like smell, are kind of unreliable in humans. Our sense of smell is nowhere near as good as that of a dog, for example. But we may have weak natural abilities that today would be called psychic that are part of human nature. Some Catholic parapsychologists, like Father Alois Weisinger, have suggested that what these are psychic powers are the remnants of the preternatural gifts that our first parents had before they fell into sin. And so maybe Adam and Eve would have had robust psychic powers, but because of the fall, they're now not as strong and not as reliable as they would have been back then. So it's if psychic functioning works, or if a person isn't even actually a psychic, but just is really good at subconsciously picking up on details and can help the police, then there's nothing wrong with that person trying. The proof is in the pudding. Can the person actually help us catch the bad guy or not? As long as they're not opening themselves up to demons or something, they're not violating church teaching on that.
Okay, Michelle?
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
Michelle, thank you very much for the call. We've got a couple more I think we can get in, so I'm going to keep moving. And let's try Chris in North Carolina, watching on YouTube. Chris, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Hi, Chris. Did I go to the wrong line, or we got no Chris? Okay. Let me find out who we got. Let's see who's on. Maybe let's try Thomas in Nashville, listening on the iHeartRadio app. Thomas, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, happy Friday, guys.
Happy Friday.
Jimmy, I want to ask you about the Divine Mercy Chapel. I personally do pray it quite a bit. It's helped me a lot over the years. Not too long ago, I stumbled across some information about it, and I don't know anything about if this is true or not, so I want to ask you that the Divine Mercy Chapel was condemned by maybe like two popes. Something about a new world was promised to her in her diary. They talked about the artist. He was a Freemason. He painted himself as Judas. And I don't know if that takes away from it, but I think the whole being condemned by popes kind of threw me off. So I want to ask you if there's any truth to that.
So as far as I'm aware, and I haven't looked into this closely, but as far as I may at some point, as far as I'm aware, the Divine Mercy Chaplet itself was not condemned, but the writings of Sister Faustina Kowalska were for a time put on the Index of Prohibited Books. And that was a warning that they might contain some problematic material. And it turned out that, if memory serves, that part of the problem was the translation that was available. And the translation had some problems, but when a better translation was made, the problems were resolved. And so it wasn't that there was a problem in the writings themselves. It was just the way they were translated into Italian. And during the reign of John Paul II, she was effectively rehabilitated. And John Paul II even included Divine Mercy Sunday in the church's liturgical calendar. So I would view the matter as having been resolved, and I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much. Let's go to Tampa, Florida, watching on YouTube. Taylor in Tampa. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, I just wanted to see if you had any advice on the topic of, you know, desires and addictions, maybe more specifically. It seems like the closer, I was actually just confirmed this Easter season, and it seems like the closer that I've been getting. Thank you. But yeah, it feels like the closer I've been getting to God and to Christ and to our Blessed Mother, the stronger that certain desires that I've had in the past and certain addictions that I've had in the past, it seems like that they have just gotten stronger and worse. And I wonder if you have any tips and tools to be able to fight something like this.
So the answer is going to depend. Now, addiction is kind of it's a category that is used in popular speech, but it's actually not used in various diagnostic manuals. Like if you look in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, you won't find addiction as a category. What you'll find instead are physical substance abuse and substance dependence. And those are two things that kind of deal with aspects of what is popularly called addiction. I'm not a huge fan of the word addiction because it has it can have misleading implications for people. Based on what you've said, it sounds like we may not even have an addiction situation here. You haven't said that you've actually given in to some of these things, just that you've had a desire to do them. So and the advice I would give depends on whether or not one is indulging these desires or whether one is merely experiencing these desires. Can you let me know which is the case?
Yeah, so they are desires that I have indulged in, unfortunately.
Okay. And second question, some things, like for example, alcohol, it's not intrinsically wrong to take alcohol. So, you know, doing alcohol abuse or alcohol dependence, that's in a different category than, for example, I'm gonna have to use a word here that I try to avoid on family radio, but it's different than masturbation or using porn, which are intrinsically wrong. And I don't want to probe more deeply into this than I have. So let me tell you what I would do in both of those cases. In the case of something like alcohol, where it's not intrinsically wrong to use alcohol, but one is using it to excess, and this would be true of other chemical substances as well, there can be some dangers in trying to just go cold turkey. And so if one is seriously abusing alcohol or another chemical substance, I generally wouldn't advise people to just stop it cold turkey. I would advise them to take a graduated approach to getting off of it. So let's say you take, I'm just making up numbers here, but let's suppose you take 10 drinks a day. Well, okay, first thing, recognize that fact. That's what your current level of consumption is. And do not go above that. So you can say, okay, for right now, this is my level of drinking, and starting tomorrow, I'm going to knock it down to 9. And you wouldn't necessarily knock out a drink every day because you need to give your body a chance to absorb, to adjust to the lower level of alcohol consumption. But I would progressively step it down, and I would measure it, how much you're actually doing. And that way you know what you're doing and you can control it until you get off of it completely. If, on the other hand, it's something like masturbation or porn use, those are intrinsically wrong. So I would say go cold turkey on those. And it's okay to go cold turkey because you're not physically dependent on those. I would then do my best to think about other things. You can replace what you're doing with the temptations with other things. You could pray, you could listen to music, you could watch a movie, you could go be with friends, but just relax, ignore the temptation to the best of your ability, and do something else that's constructive. And eventually the temptations will lessen.
Taylor, thank you very, very much for the call. Thanks to everybody who called. I'm sorry for a couple we didn't get to, but we do appreciate your call. Do it again soon. Jimmy Akin, thanks very much. Really enjoyed the hour.
My pleasure.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the second episode on the DC Sniper today. Find it at mysterious.fm or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious Worlds and you'll come to it. That does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.